From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. What is traditional Southern food? Is it fried chicken, biscuits, and sausage gravy?
I grew up in the middle of nowhere, in the coal fields, and we rarely ate meat. We didn't even have a fryer. If we fried anything, it was in a cast iron pan.
We'll spend some time today talking about the history of Southern food and how it changes from one generation to another. First, we talked a few months ago about a controversy in Athens over what's acceptable on a newspaper's opinion page.
I think the lesson here would be don't chase an audience by saying things you wouldn't say to someone at the Kroger or at the grocery store.
That's Barry Hollander, a professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. Here are your first thoughts. John Alvey tweets, "The First Amendment protects you from government interference in what you say. It doesn't protect you from the public consequences of your words." Brian Greer responds, "So long as those consequences are legal acts themselves." And John Alvey fires right back, "Agreed. Refusing to buy the product of a particular publisher, for example, would be a legal and effective method. Money talks, bull walks." We love to get your thoughts, so you can call us at 404-500-9457. If you're into the Twitter exchanges, you can find us at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. Southern food has a history as rich as its taste. Whether it's red beans and rice, cornbread and pot liquor, fried chicken, fatback, or biscuits, the history of this region's fare stretches from slave plantations to the Montgomery bus boycott to our own kitchens today. Culinary historian John T. Edge is the author of the book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. He's also the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, and we spoke with him in May. Can we start with what potlicker is? Can you call this a salvage food?
Yeah. So potlicker is the boiled down essence of a pot of greens or beans. If you throw a hock in and you throw turnips or mustard, throw a ham hock in or turnips or mustards and you cook it forever and a day, the liquid leavings at the bottom of the pot, that's the pot liquor.
And the irony is that when the pot liquor is where all the nutrients are instead of the greens that were pulled out.
It is. In enslavement era South, masters would remove the greens and reserve them for themselves. And the great perversion here is that the nutrients resided in the liquor, which the masters deigned to give to the slaves to feed them.
And this idea of salvage food, food that was trying to use every bit of a plant or animal, you describe that as being particularly Southern. Why?
We were poor for a long darn while. And out of poverty comes inventiveness. Out of poverty comes this ability to render beauty out of tragedy. And poverty is a tragic condition in which to live. And yet, out of that poverty, out of that need and want to eat close to the land, we created this beautiful food that sustained Black and white Southerners during the years after slavery, during the years of sharecropping and the like.
So you started this 60 years ago. You cover six decades in this book. Why did you start where you started?
1955 is where I began, and I began with the Montgomery bus boycotts. And that's where I believe the South begins to change. Fitfully, yes, but the modern civil rights movement is catalyzed by the brave Black men and women of Montgomery, Alabama, and changes the whole of the South. And if you want to apprehend Southern food, you want to apprehend what the South is becoming. 1955 is the year to begin.
So let's hear from Gibbs Knotts. He's a professor at the College of Charleston, and he wrote a book on Southern identity. And here he is talking about something which was probably pretty familiar to our listeners.
A lot of the tradition in the South is to have food that was grown. I mean, sometimes it was, you know, prepared by folks that didn't have a lot of money, and they kind of had to be creative with how they created flavors and put things together. And so there is an element, you know, it was farm to table before farm to table became all the rage.
So then let's go back to one of his forebears and hear kind of the same thing echoed here. This is Georgia chef and cookbook author Edna Lewis talking about city versus rural.
People living in cities can't raise their own food. It just seems that it's going to get worse the way it's produced. It has to be shipped before it's ripe. And you can't really get the true flavor of tomatoes and apples and peaches.
So would you consider farm to table to be sort of an essential element of true Southern cooking?
Farm to table is a term we apply now. It's a very modern term. It was a lived experience for people like Georgia Gilmore in Montgomery, Alabama, and it was a lived experience for people like Edna Lewis of Freetown, Virginia. It wasn't a marketing conceit. Now, too often, it's a marketing conceit. It was a way of life for Edna Lewis. They lived close to the land. They took pride in what they were able to wrench from the land, and it was everyday life.
How does that change the food, though? I mean, what's the difference for a cook, for someone designing recipes, between that turnip you just pulled out of the dirt as opposed to the turnip you got at Publix?
The turnip you just pulled out of the dirt, Edna Lewis would argue, tastes better, for one. You know from whence it came. You have pride in having raised it. It also makes an economic impact, as opposed to depending upon, you know, a farmer in California who grows your turnip, ships it in, comes through the Kroger, everybody's stepping on it, everybody else is making money on it. If you raise that crop in your backyard or on the farm or the back 40 of your plot, that economic power resides in your place and in your story, too.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to John T. Edge. He's the author of the new book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. And we will be spending most of this hour talking about Southern food. So if you want to reach out to us and tell us what your favorite Southern food is, or frankly, if you have a question, this is the time to get that question in. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us. All right. Speaking of questions, let's start with the big one, which is, for your purposes, or for culinary purposes maybe, what is the South?
Wow. So I don't think, I once thought about the South in opposition to the North. You know, and that's an old inheritance that goes back to the Civil War, to those polarities between North and South. I was once the kind of person that said, you know, I don't know about Florida. I don't know if they should belong to what we define as the South. And I don't know about Texas. You know, if you think about the South in a broad way, in an inclusive way, you recognize that pockets of Southside Chicago are deeply Southern. And you recognize the Great Migration brought so many African Americans out of the South in the early years of the 20th century. And there are pockets of Chicago that are deeply and profoundly Southern. Oakland, California, the same way. People who came out of Louisiana to win jobs in ports and the like. So my answer is the South is complicated, and our definitions of it are complicated, and the borders of it are porous. The deeper South, where I grew up in Georgia, where my family's from South Carolina, those definitions work. But I would rather think more broadly about the American South.
So even though it is decades in advance of the period that you discuss in the book, you do mention your graduate thesis in your book. And this was, you wrote it on the potlicker and corn pone debate of 1931. Now, what is pone?
Pone is an elemental cornbread, simply. You know, the kind of cornbread that is meal and salt and perhaps hot boiling water. Hot water cornbread is my favorite style. Crunchy on the outside, creamy, creamy at the core.
Okay, so this potlicker and corn pone debate of 1931 mm-hmm. was over whether you should crumble your cornbread into the potlicker or dunk it.
Correct.
And it's a great setup for the rest of the book because it's kind of funny, but it's also like, this is how seriously people take food, in the South at least.
Indeed. It was a debate in 1931. It was Huey Long, who at that point was senator-elect from Louisiana, the kingfish, the great champion of the working man, against Julian Harris.
Huey Long crumbled.
Huey Long crumbled, and Julian Harris dunked. Or it may be the other way. It doesn't really matter, you know?
they thought it mattered.
They thought it mattered. And yet, to your point, they didn't really think it mattered. They used this debate about the relative merits of dunking or crumbling cornbread into pot liquor as a way to talk about race and racism and its impact, class difference, gender inequity, regional identity. Hundreds of people wrote letters to the editor of the Atlanta Constitution, voicing their opinion about potlicker and cornpone. And when they did, they revealed all these thoughts about this wide range of things and issues that Southerners confront.
So this is what you talk about in your book as being the complicated narratives of our food. And when you're talking about that, are you only talking about race, slavery,
You start with race. You start with racism, I would say, more so than race. You start with racism and its impact on this region, because that's the grand scar. That's the most important thing to grapple with. And then you move on from there. But I begin this book during the Civil Rights Movement, at a moment when Black Southerners are leading the way for the South to grapple with its tragic history.
So then that leads us to one of the ironies of the book, which is that you're covering 60 years, and so you start in this era of poverty, where you can go to rural areas and kids are literally starving. And then you end up in this era in which poverty means obesity in many ways. Did you get an answer to how we got from there to there?
You know, it's all malnutrition. You know, it's poverty and hunger is one form of malnutrition. Overfeeding by way of fast food and other deleterious diets is another aspect of malnutrition. There are moments during our history when we thought we were going to fix this. The 1970s, which is often thought of this, you know, the kind of pet rock decade, was just a goofy moment in our history, was a really important moment in the South because Southerners, led by Lyndon Johnson and others, determined we were going to fix our broken wagon. But as for why we begin my book hungry and end it hungry in a different sort of way, a failure of human possibilities.
So then let's bring us back to sort of the roots, quite literally the roots, with Edna Lewis. She died in 2006, famous Georgia chef. She grew up in Freetown, Virginia, as you mentioned, and this is from a 1983 interview she did with NPR.
You had cows and pigs and chickens, and you utilized the composted manures of the animals, which enriched the soil. Of course, they added other ingredients like wood ashes and lime to help sweeten the soil, and the vegetables and the corn grew on its own steam without the boost from fertilizer.
So in the minute we have left before we take a break, this gets to this sort of deep love of the South, which is also combined with what you referenced before, the anger or disappointment. And how did you end up grappling with that yourself?
I'm still working. No, I mean, in all seriousness, if you read my book, and it was the same thing for me writing this book, I have moments of deep pride and just marveling at the creativity of Southerners, Black and white, responses to poverty, responses to hardship. And moments later, I'm deeply depressed by the horrific decisions we made along the way. You know, the South had many moments to redeem itself. And along the way, we're deserted by our leadership. Our best instincts don't come to the fore. Even within the foodscape, we think about someone like Lester Maddox, a restaurant owner. Civil Rights Act of 64 is on the verge of passing, and Maddox threatens and cajoles and basically drives out Black customers from his restaurant. He becomes our governor on the strength of that stance.
That's John T. Edge, author of the book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. Just ahead, a new novel about some old news in Atlanta, but first, food in the civil rights movement. This is On Second Thought.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. I am a country girl.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. All this hour, we're exploring the history of Southern food. During the Civil Rights Movement, a regular gathering place for leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. was Pascal's Restaurant in Atlanta, and it is still there today. Marshall Slack has worked there for years, long enough to have served Dr. King. And in a 2014 interview with NPR, Slack says the owners of the restaurant gave King and other civil rights leaders a place to organize.
He wanted to form the coalition and integrate restaurants and motels and schools, but he didn't have any money and didn't have anywhere to meet. So he and Andrew Young and all of them came up there to see Mr. Pascal, and he let them use one of his suites in the hotel. And by them not having any money, he only requested one thing. Dr. King said, "What is that?" He said, "That y'all eat my fried chicken."
Culinary historian John T. Edge is with us all this hour. He's author of the new book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. It's good to have you.
Thank you.
And also joining for this part of the conversation is Adrian Miller, who's a self-defined soul food scholar. Adrian's also author of the book, The President's Kitchen Cabinet. It's good to have you back, Adrian.
Thank you.
So, John T., let's go with where you began your the history portion, which is in the civil rights movement. And you start with this cook named Georgia Gilmore. Why do you start with her?
Because she embodies everything possible about linking food and civil rights. Georgia Gilmore was a cook, a midwife. She literally laid track on the railroad. She was a woman who comes from meager means and recognizes that she too has much to contribute to the movement. At the very first meeting of the Montgomery Improvement Association, when Dr. King takes the mantle of leadership, when Rosa Parks steps to the stage to receive applause for her bold stance, her refusal to go to the back of the bus, Georgia Gilmore was there at that very first meeting, and she brought a hamper of fried chicken sandwiches because she knew that her cooking could serve a role. She could raise money for the bus boycotts.
Let's actually hear from Georgia herself. This is, her group was called the Club from Nowhere. And here is Georgia Gilmore talking about that club in a 1986 interview for the PBS series Eyes on the Prize.
And so the Club from Nowhere was able to report maybe 150, 125, or 75, or maybe $200 or more a week. And which was very nice of the people, because so many of the people who didn't attend the mass meeting would give the donation to help keep the carpool going.
Adrian, there's this kind of joining of both something really practical, and that's the cooking of food and the selling of food. Everyone's got to eat, right? And then the more symbolic stance of that. How do we place Georgia Gilmore in civil rights history?
Well, she's an important figure, like so many other citizens who, you know, used what they could, their skills, what they had to support the movement. And I think there's a wonderful symmetry because the restaurant space, the eating spaces, were one of the most contested spaces in the civil rights movement. Because when you sit at a table with someone, you have to accept their humanity. And I think that's why there was so much resistance to desegregating restaurants and other eating spaces. So I just think it's such a wonderful push and pull for that struggle for humanity.
And you go on in your book, at least, John, to talk about other people who made this connection between civil rights and food. Why did that, was that connection intentional from the beginning? Did Georgia Gilmore know what she was doing?
Georgia Gilmore most certainly knew what she was doing. She leveraged skills and knowledge that she had learned cooking for her family and cooking for white families as well. And so many people did. Gilmore, like Fannie Lou Hamer, recognized that the first fight was for public accommodations, for restaurants. Second fight was voting rights. Third fight was for economic justice. And Fannie Lou Hamer pivoted, like Dr. King did late in his career. She pivoted to focusing on economic justice and argued that to raise your own crops, to have control what we now think of as food sovereignty. It's a term we use now. But food sovereignty was the ultimate goal for African Americans, was the ultimate goal of the civil rights movement, to control your means of production. So that was a civil rights issue, that was a human rights issue, and links right back to Georgia Gilmore.
And Adrian, how does this then play out with the hopes and aspirations for African Americans, and specifically to finally get their 40 acres and a mule, right? Was there a connection between the ownership of your own means of production of food to not go hungry again?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look back, even back from the early years after emancipation, a lot of the dependency cycle that was created for African Americans was based on food. Because with the sharecropping system, there was a disincentive to grow your own food and grow more of the commodity crop. And so a lot of rural African Americans became beholden to the commissary that was created by the landlord, who was the former plantation master. So you start to see this cycle of dependency deepening based on food. And so the right to grow your own food, to have your own control, to decide what you're going to eat and get healthy food has persisted even to the present day, especially with the conversation about food deserts and the inability to get good, fresh food and produce in a lot of places where African Americans live. So you see this common theme over a century, really.
And that kind of brings us to the issue of appropriation, John T., because for this food that, as we've mentioned, has such a deep meaning in terms of pride and independence, then we get to the part where the many of the people that we know that started championing Southern food were not African American at all.
Correct.
So why?
Why does that happen?
Yeah.
It happens because as Southern food gentrifies in the 1970s, really the 80s and 90s is where it begins, Southerners, white Southerners, discover new value in this poverty-engendered food. And they open restaurants and they
use... Are we including Colonel Sanders in this?
We are, although he took a different tack. But we can talk Colonel Sanders if you want to.
We can in a moment, but finish your thought.
But so in the 1980s, this new generation of chefs who are rehabilitating the South and rehabilitating and weaving new narratives about the South, they begin to open restaurants, and they call these new Southern restaurants. 1982 is kind of the watershed year. Crook's Corner opens in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Highlands Bar and Grill opens in Birmingham, Alabama. And the difference here is these are white chefs with access to capital. Frank Stitt, famously, his mother mortgaged her house so that he could open a restaurant. That sounds like she took extraordinary steps, but the reality is she had a house to mortgage. So access to capital means that white chefs are able to step in and tell these stories. So now when we talk about cultural appropriation, at the root problem there, it's issues of capital still. And it was evident in 82. It's evident today.
So, Adrian, you're just about to add on.
Yeah. I wanted to say part of the story is also intentional from African Americans. With the elevation and popularization of soul food in the 1960s, you had many in the African American community saying that whites, especially Southern whites, couldn't understand certain elements of the cuisine, even though it was a shared cuisine. And so I think we're still living with the legacy of that today, because soul became black, Southern became white, mm-hmm. even though many of these foods were shared in common. So that complicates the story as well.
What's the difference, Adrian, between soul food and Southern food?
Soul food tastes better.
So in the couple minutes that we have left then, John T., let's deal with Colonel Sanders. Since what we're talking about here is the intertwining of politics and food, mm-hmm. I feel like Colonel Sanders is an important role to play in that intersection.
He is. Colonel Sanders may have been the ultimate salesperson for the Moonlight Magnolia myth of the South. You know, he dressed in this white suit and a black bolo tie. He affected this kind of plantation mien. He took on the title. It was an honorific. He didn't earn it.
Yeah,
it was
he wasn't
an honorific. Colonel Sanders, and he sold a traditional Southern food, a hyper-traditional Southern food, born of farms, born of a chicken scratching around in the backyard, a food that African-American women had already established their expertise in. So in swoops the colonel with his garb, with his kind of salespersonship, and in essence, you know, swoops up this black food, claims it for himself, improves it, quote unquote, by cooking it in a pressure cooker. So he modernizes his food. Pressure cooker allows you to cook fried chicken more quickly. So he co-opts, repackages, streamlines, and resells to America this hyper-traditional Southern food as a modern new innovation, and finds great success.
John T. Edge is author of the new book, The Pot Liquor Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. And we also heard from food scholar Adrian Miller. He's author of the book, The President's Kitchen Table. And one place that the history of Southern food is being remade is at Savannah's Gray Restaurant. Mashama Bailey is the executive chef there and joins us from Savannah. Hi, Mashama.
Hi, how you doing?
It's good to have you with us.
This is so good to be here.
Well, let's then go first to sort of defining our terms. Let me play you a comment from Alfreda Lockett, the executive chef at Mima's Restaurant in Macon. And here she is talking about the fact that she believes there's a real difference between soul food and Southern food.
I say Southern style food, and all of it is good for the soul, and I take ownership of preparing it where all people, all nationality, is not overly seasoned. It's just seasoned to a point, and then you take it to the next degree.
Is there a difference, Mashama, between soul food and Southern food?
Absolutely. I think that the food that I grew up on was soul food. It was basically what my mom put in the pot, and she seasoned it how she wanted to. She grew up on that food. I think Southern food is a little bit more regional. It's broader, I think.
And okay, so John T., as we bring both soul food and Southern food into the modern age, they've had to change. They've had to change for some practical reasons. In other words, they need to get healthier. But what other ways has Southern food and soul food changed?
I mean, one of the propulsions for soul food is a kind of reclaiming of the Black diet. And so that was one change that begins in the 1970s. The naming of soul food, late 60s, early 70s, the naming of soul food in the same way that soul music came to the fore in that moment. It was a political decision on the part of African Americans to claim that diet, to reframe it. It's not Southern food. It's not the food of enslavement. It's soul food. It's particular to us. And it becomes a more urban food than rural food, and the changes in the South from rural to urban migrations, soul food comes out of that moment too.
So, Mashama, I remember reading a complaint from another Southern chef who's, I've forgotten who it was, but they were saying, you know, when you go to culinary school, you don't learn how to make Southern food. You learn how to make European-style food and French food. Has that changed?
No. when I went to culinary school, we learned about all the European sort of diets and how they ate and cooked and their techniques. And you don't learn anything about American food. You learn how they think of it as sort of like a melting pot, more of tradition. And I think we're starting to grow into, we're growing older as a country, and we're starting to identify ourselves more regionally, I think. And I think that's the importance of really classifying different parts of the United States and how we grow food and how we cook food and different techniques. There are pit masters and fishermen and oystermen, and all these people have different cooking techniques. And I think that needs to be celebrated in culinary schools in America, and they're not yet, I don't think.
So one of the things that's happened, John T., is that Southern chefs have started to reclaim very ancient styles of Southern cooking. So here's Stephen Satterfield. He's co-owner and executive chef at Miller Union in Atlanta, recently won a James Beard Award. He came on the show to cook for us a little while back, and he's talking about the use of historic ingredients.
I just have some toasted sesame seeds here. These are Bene seeds, an heirloom African seed that came over with the slave ships many, many centuries ago and made their way into the culinary landscape of the South. So they've really have become like the heralded sesame seed of the South.
And you talk about this in the book when you're discussing the 90s, the rise of the scholar chef and how that changes Southern cooking. What does change?
There's a new respect for Southern ingredients, Southern techniques, and Southern peoples. And what chefs do, working in lockstep oftentimes with academics, is they dig back into the Southern larder, they dig back into the Southern record to find the stories, to find the specific ingredients, like the Bene, of which Stephen Satterfield talked. And they leverage those ingredients and the narratives about those ingredients for modern restaurant cookery. There's a kind of reappraisal and a renaissance that happens in that moment. And the best of those chefs, like Stephen Satterfield, point back to the origins and talk about their West African origins as opposed to scooping them up and presenting them grandly on white tablecloths.
We have a tweet from Terry Anulowitz, who says, "The Gift of Southern Cooking by Lewis and Peacock is my desert island cookbook." And the couple minutes that we have left, John T., do you have a desert island cookbook, or is it more like a desert island library?
I would buy into The Gift of Southern Cooking by Miss Lewis and Scott Peacock because it's this emblem of a biracial South. It's a Black chef and a young white chef working together to create this beautiful testament of Southern food. It's an older woman and a young man, a straight woman and a gay man. It's all of the South wrapped up into one book. It also cooks really well. If you walked into our kitchen in Oxford, Mississippi and opened up that book, you would see it splattered to hell and back with grease, with chocolate, with everything that we've splattered upon it as my wife and I've cooked through the years.
What about you, Mashama? Do you have a desert island cookbook?
Definitely. It's The Taste of Country Cooking by Edna Lewis.
Mashama Bailey is the executive chef at the Gray Restaurant in Savannah. And we also spoke with John T. Edge, author of the book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
It was fun.
Coming up, a novel that takes us back to a time when neighborhoods were segregated and black police officers were few and far between. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. Tomorrow, we'll talk with NPR's Marilyn Geewax about the improving picture of Georgia's economy. But we want to hear your story financially. Have you recovered from the recession? Are things better for you this year than they were last year? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for that discussion. In the Jim Crow South, the races were segregated by law. As racial tensions grew, though, some police departments added African-American officers to their squads. Atlanta hired 8 men in 1948, but their authority was really restricted. These officers inspired Thomas Mullen's novel, Darktown. I first met Mullen last year, and it's a pleasure to have him back to talk about his new book, the sequel, called Lightning Men. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's first talk about that title, because it refers to a specific thing. Who are the Lightning Men?
So Lightning Men refers to a group that existed in Atlanta. It was our very own homegrown fascist organization. They called themselves the Columbians. They dressed in Nazi brown shirts, complete with SS lightning bolt patches on their sleeve, designed after the Nazi stormtrooper lightning bolt. And they made it a point of showing up in neighborhoods where African Americans had bought a house in previously white-only neighborhoods, and showing up to intimidate them and start fights. They recruited other adherents at mills around town. And they finally got shut down in the late 40s when they went even further than that and advocated overthrowing the state government.
And what was interesting to me was that I would have assumed they would have been in league with, or at least friendly with, the KKK, but your books suggest that was not the case.
Yeah, there are all sorts of different variations of white supremacy. And you had the Ku Klux Klan, obviously, and then you had the Columbians. The KKK kind of looked down on the Columbians as these goofy kid dropouts who were a little too enamored with Hitler. Remember, this is after World War II. This is after we fought a war to defeat fascism. And a few years later, here we have a Nazi-style group operating in Atlanta. So the Klan kind of looked down their noses at them. But then you also had neighborhood associations that looked down at the Klan, even though they really wanted the same thing, which was to keep blacks out of white neighborhoods.
But it makes for such a great foil in a fictional novel, because you're African Americans are sort of beset on all sides. There's just, it's really, friends are hard to come by. And even the one white detective who has been helping them and certainly helped them in the first book, he himself says, I'm not doing this ever again.
Yeah, I'm always interested in finding the different fault lines in different communities. And so for a book like this, obviously, there's a lot of conflict between African Americans and whites. But I'm also interested in looking into what divides the white community and what divides the black community. So within the white community, you did have some progressives who wanted, you know, African Americans to be treated better. They, you know, wanted anti-lynch legislation. They wanted to revoke the poll tax and things like that. They thought black schools should be better funded. But there were also, they also still couldn't imagine a world without segregation. They still thought that the races should be kept separate. So there's a lot of disagreement among whites about how to do things. And within the black community, there was a lot of disagreement as well about how far should they go, how hard should they push. And so, you know, as a novelist, I like finding those tensions and finding ways to exploit them.
I mean, it makes it sound like we're talking about a history book. And really, this is a mystery slash thriller at its heart. The problem for me is that it's really hard to talk about any plot points without spoiling, because you get a spoiler almost from the very beginning of the novel. The character of the first person who gets out of prison and is released is someone that I can't say who that is, because who he
yeah,
is
that's true.
Is important. But he says this one thing, and I want to read it. The character named Jeremiah, he's just out of prison, and they have the cops have set up a system whereby they can somebody's released from prison can be sent back almost immediately to prison. And he says, "Why do they act this way? I don't understand this world, not this world meaning the outside as opposed to prison, but this world meaning everything." Does that sentiment change at all by the end?
Maybe.
As a symbol, I guess.
Maybe not for him, but I mean, all the characters are trying to understand what's going on in this crazy world. And it was a time of great change. I mean, it was right before a lot of the seminal victories of the civil rights movement that we learn about in school. Like the Montgomery bus boycott's going to be in 55, and Brown versus Board of Education is going to be in 54, but this book is set in 50. So all of those currents and threads are still going on at that time, but nothing's happened yet. And within the Black community at this time, there's also a sense of disappointment. People thought there were going to be a lot of changes with World War II, since, you know, we fought a war to defeat fascism, and African American newspapers thought that we should also be fighting to overthrow Jim Crow at the same time. They called it the Double V campaign, for victory over fascism and victory over Jim Crow. But that hadn't quite happened yet. And so I think there's a lot of confusion going on all sides. The world had just gone through so much change with the Depression, with the war, and everybody was kind of wondering what's going to happen next.
There's a point in there where you're, as a novelist, are imagining how these sort of backroom deals had to be made. And it's one where they're sort of, they're negotiating where the lines of segregation will be drawn in a neighborhood. And it struck me because many people think of the Atlanta Way, capital Atlanta, capital Way, as something to be proud of. That's how Atlanta has escaped a lot of the racial turmoil that has beset other cities like Los Angeles or Detroit or New York. But in your book, the Atlanta Way kind of feels a little bit gross.
Interesting.
It feels a little bit like people simply not taking a stand or avoiding conflict in order to keep the peace when they really needed to have the conflict. And that was all coming out of your imagination? Or really my question is, how much did you find out about how these deals were made or not?
I tried to make that as based on fact as possible. So you, again, yeah, I am a novelist. This is fiction. And so I'm going to exploit things for tension and suspense as much as I can. But I want the surrounding world and the politics to be as dead on accurate as possible. And you'll create my little fictional events within that structure. And yeah, the Atlanta Way, it can look that way. It can look a little backward looking back through time, especially, you know, after the mid-60s, when you had this generational change within the civil rights leadership, and, you know, a younger generation that came of age in about 60, 61, 62, saying, like, we're tired of the way that our fathers are going about it, this incrementalism, this asking for crumbs off the white man's table. We need to push harder. And, you know, obviously it's easy to agree with that now. In 1950, it was more complicated because, you know, Atlanta was only 40 some odd years removed from a race riot where whites rioted and attacked blacks and drove them out of downtown. So for black community leaders at that time, you know, they were working hard to win concessions from the white majority, concessions like black officers hired in 1948, concessions like allowing certain neighborhoods that had previously been all white, you know, opening those up to African Americans. And that's a scene in the book that you're referring to, where some black community leaders sit down with white community leaders and try to negotiate, okay, well, where can black families move into safely? And looking back on it now, and one of the characters in the book, a young police officer, he's angered by this. He's like, well, we're bartering away where we can live. This is America. We should be able to live wherever we want. That's the perspective of Officer Lucius Boggs, who's kind of sickened by these negotiations that he observes. But his father, Reverend Boggs, who I see as a contemporary of Martin Luther King Sr., you know, the older wave of leadership at that time, you know, he feels like, we're doing what we can to avoid another race riot. We're doing what we can to make things better for our people while avoiding violence. And, you know, I've worked hard to get this far. I don't want to hear you criticizing me. And that was a generational conflict that, you know, we would see more of in the years ahead.
So I want to read, I alluded earlier to the white detective who decides he's putting his family in danger by helping African Americans. He doesn't want to do this anymore. And his family situation gets very complicated in this book in a really interesting way. But it says, if any Negro officer ever asked another favor of him, he would decline. He wouldn't spit in their faces, no, but neither would he take a single risk for their cause ever again. He had his own battles to fight, and he couldn't afford to weaken himself by associating with the troubles that shadowed their every step. How much did you try to imagine yourself in the same position? To what extent did you think to yourself, well, what would I have done?
Well, first I should mention that passage you read is very late in the book. So a lot has gone on to get him to that point. And when I wrote this book and when I wrote the previous book, Darktown, you know, I was aware of the fact that in a lot of other books about race written by white people or films about race, starring a lot of white Hollywood actors, there's this character that kind of gets created of the white savior, where even if it's a story about civil rights in which you would think African-Americans should be starring or at the very least playing a very pivotal role, weirdly, through some alchemy, the story winds up being about, you know, saving the soul of the white people or the white people finally stepping up and doing the right thing. And although that is important, I didn't want that to happen with my book. And so there is this character of Dennis Rakestraw. He goes by Rake. He's a white cop, and he wants to be better than a lot of the white cops around him. He's not a violent thug. He's not a racist. He was raised in a household where you didn't use racial epithets and things like that. So he wants to do better, and he wants to see the black cops succeed. But one of the reasons he wants to see them succeed is because if the black cops succeed and the city hires more of them, then the city will have enough black cops to patrol all the black neighborhoods. And white cops like Rake will never have to go to a black... Yeah, exactly. Because even progressive-minded whites back then still had a hard time imagining a world without segregation. So he's being pushed in the previous book and in this book to try to do the right thing and kind of cross the color line to help. But it doesn't always go well for him, and it didn't always go well for some white people who did take those steps. And often they would end up going back when they'd realize how hard it was and the pressures that it put on their family, the pressures that it put on their business. They'd realize, you know, I don't want to deal with this anymore. This is somebody else's problem. I want to back away. And that's, he comes to that point, you know, by the end of the book because of some things that happen.
If you're joining us, I'm speaking with Thomas Mullen. He's author of the new novel, Lightning Man. It's a sequel to his other novel, Darktown. So there's another sense in this book of how small a town Atlanta is. So you get this sense of space, right? They're traveling, and in a lot of ways, they cover a lot of ground, both in this and the earlier novel. But in the other sense, it's a small town. And I wonder how you got there. I mean, it must have been through your research that you kind of kept thinking, look, it's these same characters showing up again and again and again, or at least that's how I imagined it.
Yeah, well, when you're writing a novel, you want certain little coincidences or certain plot lines overlap. But also, I think something that's been remarked upon a lot is that in the modern world, we lack a certain sense of community that our parents or grandparents had, that in neighborhoods, people looked out for each other or knew everybody. So it's not just, I'm not necessarily trying to say that Atlanta's a small town, but certain neighborhoods would feel small, and that, you know, if you were raised in the Sweet Armor community, you would know a lot of other people from there too, and you'd know their brothers and sisters and past girlfriends and things like that. And so through the course of the book, you wind up certain characters know each other better than maybe you'd realize before. And I thought that was interesting to play with.
Did you know the end of the book before you started writing?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know if I remember anymore. Usually I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going, but I don't know exactly how I'm going to get there. So there's a few scenes towards the end that I had to figure some things out, especially with a crime novel where you have various intersecting plot lines. You want to make sure they make sense. And sometimes I'll be writing a book and I'll think, okay, this character is going to have a deep, dark secret, and I don't know what it is yet. And as I'm writing, I'll eventually figure it out, or I'll be doing some research and I'll discover some interesting thing that happened. I was like, ooh, I'm going to borrow that. So I think I knew most of it, but some of it was stuff that I worked out as I went.
And is this part of a trilogy?
I'm not going to limit myself to three. I think it's kind of fun. When I had the idea for Darktown, which was set in 1948 when the city first hired its 8 black cops, I was struck by the fact that it's right before the civil rights movement really takes off, and that so much is going to change in Atlanta, in the South, and in America over the next 20 years. And as I was writing Dark Town, it was getting longer and longer, and I was coming up with more subplots and more characters, and I quickly realized, you know, this could easily become like an 800-page doorstop of a novel if I wasn't careful. And I didn't want that to happen because not many people want to read 800-page novels. So I held some things back. So there were things in Lightning Men that I had initially been writing to go into Dark Town that I later decided to pull back and save for a later book. So I don't have a magic number in mind, but I think there's a lot of different stories worth telling, and I think it'd be interesting to see what happens to some of these officers. You know, in 55, when the Montgomery bus boycott's going on and Martin Luther King Jr., a native Atlantan, becomes a national figure. What happens in 1960 when King moves to Atlanta at the same time that this younger generation of civil rights activists, you know, takes over and there are more demonstrations in Atlanta than there had been before? You know, what happens in the mid-60s? Like, it's interesting to trace the evolution of Atlanta and the evolution of our country and, you know, marry that to crime stories sort of as a, like the spoonful of sugar that makes maybe a reader able to embrace what can otherwise be difficult, heavy material.
Have you heard from any cops after they read Dark Town? Did you hear from actual officers?
I've spoken with a few officers. I'm not sure how many I've spoken with who'd read the book first.
Or admitted it.
Yeah. But I've spoken, I mean, a lot of people have been interested in it. And when I've given talks, some cops have come up to me afterwards, or people who were former officers or whose dad or uncle or cousin or sister was a cop and have shared different stories they've told, not just in Atlanta, but in other parts of the country, and how, you know, different police departments have been integrated better than others. And in some cities, it took a long time before white and black cops could work together well.
Did you get any good ideas from these stories that you heard from either cops or their family?
Yeah, some. I'm always filing away little ideas because since I want to write a number of these books, I've got a giant piece of paper at home, two giant pieces of paper with different post-it notes, color-coded subplot ideas or character ideas or historical event ideas that I'm kind of rearranging as I go. But it's been fun. It's been fun to have a project like this. And it's been a fun, for me, you know, an excuse to learn more about Atlanta history and become more, you know, bound to the area that I live in.
But the people at the library near you must know your face and name.
At this point, I think so. But there's a few different libraries I make a habit of going to, so I'm going to different parts of the city.
Thomas Mullen, author of the very well-researched new novel, Lightning Men. Thomas, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today, but let me ask you again. Give me suggestions for my Southern food bucket list. I grew up in California, so tell me where to go to experience really good Southern food. Modern or traditional, doesn't matter. Call and leave me a message at 404-500-9457 or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.